here with Jer Sklar, the creative force. I was going to say writer, director, but you're so much more than that on the film Tom of Your Life, which has its Chicago premiere this coming weekend, May 8th at the Music Box Theater here in Chicago. How you doing?
I'm good. I'm good, Ian. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. It's a pleasure to talk to you. I'm really excited to get into everything that went into this movie. So let's just dive right in.
Sure.
So your career has been really unique. You grew up in Highland Park, Illinois. You moved to LA to study acting and music, became a development exec, and wound up producing stuff with Chris Rock. And yet you moved back to Chicago to study filmmaking and do your first feature. What does Chicago have over LA, which you would think would be the more natural environment for making a big movie? What does Chicago have over LA?
I think the thing that Chicago has over LA is very personal, and just in that, like, growing up, it was just kind of the movie, the place that I fantasized about, you know, making a movie, just being driven around at night by my parents going out to dinner or something from the burbs. And it was, you know, very magical. Like, I don't know, I was always just making a movie in my mind, you know, as a child, as many children do for some reason. You're just watching the L trains, and you're watching, looking at the buildings, and just out of, like, absolute, you know, I was probably born a filmmaker, and the set that I was born into using was Chicago. And the fact that I've just never seen movies filmed in Chicago quite like how I see it, just has been a kind of a lifelong obsession to be able to at least make a few, like, Chicago centric films. That's what led me back here, to some degree, really wanting to make movies here and use Chicago as a backdrop. And then my parents are still here, and I was basically, I kind of, you know, I had a little career going. I didn't have, like, a major career going to, you know, I had a screenwriting career going a little bit and produced a little here and there, but I wasn't really liking the way my career was kind of shaping out. And I had just sort of missed the digital age of film school. Like, I you know, when I graduated from undergrad film school at Columbia College, I was slicing movies with razor blade, which always makes it sound like you were, like, born in the 1800s. Because it is really, like, the advancement from, like, cutting and taping pieces of film together to where we are now. It wasn't that long ago when it was just, like, it was the 90s. You were still, like, kind of cutting and taping pieces of film together.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah, I was really jealous of, like, all the young, you know, women and men growing up in this field. Because I was still just, like, a guy with a script under his arm, who had just no, like, I barely could use a computer, honestly. I was like, I thought it was time to just reassess my career and go to grad school and just spend, like, a solid 4 years just, like, kind of playing catch up with all the digital toys that are out there. And I kicked around Hollywood enough so long trying to get a movie made the old-fashioned way of getting a star, and, you know, then you play a waiting game and you try to get the stars aligned, and had many close calls happen in pursuing it that way, but honestly just was never really able to get, you know, to helm my own feature. So that's a long answer and a short answer, but the long answer was, yeah, it was like, yeah, I decided to come back to Chicago to go to grad school at DePaul and start raising money to shoot a feature as my thesis, and then also look after my parents, and then just, you know, I love Chicago, so it's great to be here. Hopefully I can stay here and make a living here. So,
well, was there a light bulb moment, or a not so great moment, something that really was the catalyst for you deciding, I've had enough of this, I got to go back to Chicago? Because the film itself is very personal. It's the live, you know, living your life to the fullest because you don't know how much time you have, really. So did you have that moment where you're like, I'm, you know, getting older. I haven't quite achieved my dreams. Now it's now or never.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's true. That's exactly what it was. I had a moment. I think I was working for a TV show called Totally Biased. I was living in New York and was working for Chris Rock. And it was a really cool, obviously it sounded like a cool job. It was a cool job. I was like, I'm living in New York, like this great city. And I'm, it was interesting. There was a hurricane. When was that? That was Hurricane, I want to say Sandy, maybe. I forget when this big New York hurricane was, or which. Sound right. I get it mixed up. I think it was Hurricane Sandy. Anyways, so this is like around 2013 or so, and or maybe 12 or 13, whatever.
That was the famous one with Chris Christie yelling people to get off the beach or something, right? In yeah. Jersey. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. 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 Yeah, it was really nuts. Anyways, so I'm kind of stranded in my Airbnb apartment for a time, and there was an artist living with us at the time there, this woman from Germany, and she was showing me her sort of installation art. It was like mix of kind of video and sculpture, and I just was like, I was looking at it, and then she said, so what have you done? Like, you're a filmmaker. I'm interested in what you're doing. And I, at this time, I had some really kind of cool stuff. I had some, like, a pilot that I made called Hollywoodn't that was going to get launched on HBO. It didn't quite happen. And I had some other thing, and I had Totally Biased. And I had a $5 million movie that I wrote that got made into a movie, and I was sort of like ghost director of it. And it was all, it's all great stuff. It's all really stuff. It was, you know, paid for my living, my livelihood. But it honestly wasn't, none of it was like at that particular moment, I was like, no, you know what I'm going to show her? I'm going to show her my undergrad film school, like montage of these sort of crazy art films that I made with my own music to them. And, you know, that'll impress her or whatever. But it was sort of interesting to me that, like, in that moment, I was like, I'm not doing what I'm supposed to be doing. I'm working in the industry, so yes, I kind of am, but I have a very clear vision of what I want to do, and I'm not doing it. And not everybody does have a clear vision. Not that it's like, that's like, ooh, I'm so special or something, but just, I have a very clear vision of what I wanted to do, and I should go do that. And this woman's artwork it was an awakening of back to like getting back in touch with my artist self and stop with this whole, like, you know, I don't want to work in the industry. I don't want to work in the industry. I want to make movies. Now, yes, I would like to make movies in the industry, but I don't just want to, like, yeah. And that's kind of what I was doing. I sort of caught myself in, like, you know, hey, this sounds awesome. You're working on a TV show. You're in the industry. Your boss is Chris Rock. Like, what's your problem? Like, this sounds awesome to most people who want to work in the industry, but, you know, you get what I'm saying. So I think that was the moment where I was like, all right, I need to, you know, and then even after that, I actually did get a chance to possibly make a feature film that was a horror movie. And that's kind of how I got my start in screenwriting, was writing horror and sci-fi stuff, which I like. And you know, big John Carpenter fan as a kid. But I was in the process of making a demo trailer for this movie that looked like it was possibly going to get funded. And it was a horror movie, and I was proud of my script and everything. But in the middle of making this trailer for this horror movie called Air Disturbance, I noticed that I didn't give a shit. I noticed that I just was like, you know what? This is a good script. This is a good horror movie. This will be a good genre movie. This really could launch my career, this movie. I don't care about it. I want someone else to make it. I'll be fine writing the script, selling it. This is not what I'm trying to say. This is not what I want to be. So nothing wrong with, obviously, I'm not judging horror movies or sci-fi. They're great, and I do love them. I watch a lot of them. but it's not really. So it was a combination of the German artist trapped with her in a hurricane, and then actually getting a chance to make my first movie, which didn't happen. And it was sort of, when the money didn't come in for Air Disturbance, I basically said, good, I'm going to go to grad school and I'm going to go make my exact, like the kind of movie that I want to make as my thesis film. And I'll start raising money for it now. And that's what I did. More to your point was that I was getting older. I'm in my 40s and I'm like, all right. So we started trying to make a feature film. My producing partner and I, James Sharp, started trying to raise money for a movie, and we were raising money for it. We raised about $80,000 for it. And we spent a good amount of time, a couple years, I should say, raising money for it. And then it was getting close to time to go into production for this movie. And we realized $80,000 was not going to be able to make this other movie that I wanted to make. And I said, James, I have this other idea for a movie about a guy that's born, and he's living his whole entire lifespan of a human being, but it's all happening in a day. And I'm sort of riffing on Oedipus's like riddle of the Sphinx and how, like, what walks on four legs in the morning, two legs in the afternoon, and three legs at night. And the answer is a human being, because they're crawling, and then they're walking on two legs, and then they're walking with a cane. So I was ruminating about that, and I was ruminating about trying to make a movie. Like, I love John Carpenter's movie Starman. I love
yes.
that movie a lot. It's really romantic. And I was wanting to make a road movie about a mismatched couple. And I was like, I don't know, maybe one of them's an alien. And I'm like, no, that's been done before. So I had these other things ruminating. And I said to James, yeah, why don't we do this movie called Tom of Your Life, where this guy's born, this child's born, and he's aging and evolving 4 years on each hour. And he's like, oh my God, that sounds awesome. I want to read that script. And I said, yeah, so do I. I don't have it. So I basically I wrote a script in about a month, and then I showed all the investors, like, and I said, I can't make the other Chicago mob movie that I want to make. But I think this will be a better movie for the budget, and I can do my own music to it, and it'll be a good vehicle to, you know. So I convinced them, and then that led to, you know, getting a like about $150,000 together to make Tom. I'm rambling a little bit. Sorry.
No, this is what we're here to talk about, because I'm very curious, especially this next point, because you're talking about raising the funds. You know, it's in a lot of ways it's easier than ever to make a movie. You know, people shoot stuff on their phones, they edit on their phones or laptops, but there's still the kind of the bread and butter stuff, especially if you want to shoot a film that's as ambitious as Tom of Your Life. It's a road movie. It's very much a Chicago film. How the hell did you get the permits to shoot on the L train at night and on the Chicago architectural tour? Was that complicated or easy? Because a lot of first-time filmmakers, especially, you know, student filmmakers, I guess, would go, you know, I can shoot me and my friends in an apartment. It'll be a twofer, and then that's it. Oh. I can get 80 minutes out of that. You're going all over the place. It's like Adventures in Babysitting in terms of the amount of locations you find in Chicago.
Yeah, it's, I know, those... Yes, I knew I did not want to make like another four people in an eggshell painted walled Chicago apartment. Like, yes. So I knew I had a lot of experience in Hollywood working in kind of the D-list sort of movie industry in a way. Like, we're making these movies for, you know, a couple hundred $1,000, $500,000, yet making sure that you've got these right elements involved to make it look like you made a movie for whatever, $2 million. And and all these movies were like, they were terrible. I didn't like any of those. But I did learn a lot. I did learn a lot. Like you hear historically, people learning a lot from like working with Roger Corman and that whole thing. Like you do, you learn a lot from that kind of part of the industry of cranking out like movies as just product, and then going to the markets and learning like what the buyers are really looking for. And you don't want that to totally lead you completely, because you'll just make a bunch of garbage action movies with like Jean-Claude Van Damme's cousin in them. You know, that's kind of what like AFM movies are. But those things they sell. There's these ingredients that will sell, and what sells is like big production value and big beautiful shots and, you know, landscape, you know. So if you're not making like an action violent movie, and you're not making a Jesus movie, and you're not making pornography, like there are these little things that you need, you know, and you don't have a star in your movie, well, you better have a real kick-ass like concept that's sort of like, oh, that sounds interesting to like the layperson. And then you better have like, yeah, you better deliver at least a little bit that it like looks like a big enough movie, even if it's cheap. It's like there are ways to sort of, you know, play with your money in a wise way. So I think I brought that to the whole artistry of it, I hope, you know.
I want to get back to that in a second, because I got a big question. But before we move on, after all your experience, you know, in Hollywood, and you know, I use Hollywood as the generic term for the entertainment industry, right? Going back to film school for your master's, was it like a Rodney Dangerfield kind of moment where you're just in this class with a bunch of millennials, or were there other adults who had just, you know, kind of rediscovered a passion later on? Was it a mixture of things? And how much did your real world experience enhance or even clash with what you were being taught in school?
That's really, this is fun, man. Yeah. You know, grad school was a nightmare, as you can possibly imagine. Honestly, it really was. It was not, and it was a nightmare. A lot of it was because of me, because of like my expectations were just wrong. They were so wrongheaded. I was going in there thinking like, you know, this will be fun. And like, I've worked with millennials. I've had millennials as bosses. It's like, whatever. I don't care. You know, this will be great. I'm sure I'll get along with the students, and they'll look at me as like, oh, cool, this guy's had all this experience. Let's work with him on his movies. And just all of it wrong. Like all of it, most of the faculty, most of the students, they just were absolutely threatened and hated me. And I don't know about hated me, but just like, it was not, I learned after that first year to just like shut up and go do my own thing, because nobody wanted to hear me. Nobody wanted to like hear like, why are you in school? If you, you know so much, why are you? So I just sort of shut up, and like, I just became somebody that was like, all right, I'm going to learn how to edit. Okay. I'm going to learn how to record my own music. Okay. I'll learn how to shoot. You know, I didn't shoot the film, but yes, I could film a little bit. I shot some of my movie. I mean, a lot of the second unit, like just road shots are just me and another second unit guy going around shooting stuff. But I guess the point was, it was really rough. It was really rough. I learned a lot about like working with millennials and working with the sort of the Gen Z generation, which I sort of felt like the Gen Z generation, there was some sort of course correction made after the millennials. I swear, sorry guys, I don't know if I'm offending how many people I'm offending, but I even think some millennials know that, like, oh yeah, what happened with us? Why are we so messed up? The Gen Z crowd, the 18, 19, 20 year olds who were in undergrads, who were in college, like I found them to be more mature and more just like, oh, he's older and he's done stuff. Cool. What does he have to say? Like they weren't as like threatened. It wasn't some sort of, yeah. So I don't know. It was rough, man. I don't know. The other reason you could say like, why am I the writer, director, actor, composer and editor of my own film. Why couldn't I make any friends? It's like, could you make any friends to help you out? And the answer was like, not really. I mean, I'm really glad I learned how to do all those things. And I'd certainly, you know, maybe I'll make another movie or two like this, where I'm kind of like, you know, comically wearing all the hats, or wearing all the hats, wearing a lot of hats. But yeah, I just, quite honestly, man, I did all those roles for this movie because I just knew that I didn't have a lot of money. And I also knew that nobody was going to have the skill level that I have and work for nothing on it and throw their entire life into it to make it as good as it could. So, you know, that's kind of, it was rough. I don't know. I'm going all over the place with this, but yeah, going to grad school and being, I was not the Rodney Dangerfield character of like, hey, everybody, party with the older guy. I think I was sort of thinking it was going to be more like that at first. And it was more by the end of it, by even like the fourth month I was there, there was just sort of like,
You're more like Chevy Chase. You're like Chevy Chase in Community.
Yes. It went from, I thought they'd all be like, right, he's Rodney from Back to School. Isn't he fun? And this, they, it turned out I was Chevy Chase in Community, a sour, bitter old man.
kids. Well, so going back to making the most of what you can put on the screen, if you don't have, you know, all the resources in the world, two talents hit me like a lightning bolt watching Time of Your Life. The first one was, I hope I get her name right, Baze Bouzon. Is that right?
Baze Bouzon.
Yeah. Baze Bouzon. Yeah. You know, she plays Jess, who's the traveling companion of your Tom character. There's just something about her look, her delivery, her presence reminded me, talking about Community, a little bit of Alison Brie, a little bit of Rebecca Hall. I mean, this is her feature film debut, and she's just amazing. I feel like I should have seen her in other things. The second person was Christopher Reggiano, the cinematographer who shot one of my favorite films of 2019, Jennifer Reeder's Knives and Skin. So how did you get hooked up with these two phenomenal talents?
Yeah. That's great. I'm so glad that you're like noticing them and talking about them. Cause yeah, Baze was just lucky as hell. Honestly, I saw a short film that a professor did at DePaul called Speed Dating. And the name is escaping. The name is flying out of my head at the moment. I'll think of her name in a second, the filmmaker. But I saw her film Speed Dating. And it was this really excellent short film that actually had no dialogue in it. And it was all kind of had humans in it, but it was animated. It was like stop motion. It was really weird. But her Baze, and Baze is like wearing like a black wig in it. And she's like, but her eyes were so amazing. It was like it was absolutely one of those just like I can't take my eyes off of her. She's like kind of riveting, like very unique. And so yeah, so basically, you know, I reached out to her just to put an audition tape to us, and she was very clearly like got the whole levels of, I mean, it's not an easy role. Like she's a messed up person. And I didn't want her to be like easily, I didn't want her to be easily likable. I wanted her to be like kind of a, like you sort of think she's like, oh, she's so sweet for doing this. And then you sort of start finding out more about her and you're like, actually, I don't like her. What's her problem, this woman? So you really go on a journey with her as well as you're finding out more and more about her, and you kind of love her and then don't like her. And then, yeah. And then, so it needed to be in the hands of an actor that really, you know, an actress that really had a lot of dynamics to her. And Baze really has a lot of dynamics to her. She's a complex, interesting, smart, talented woman. Yeah. So that's how I got in touch with Baze. And Chris, I have a friend of mine named Lyle Vincent, who's a great cinematographer, who shot, you probably know the movie, what's the movie I was about to say? Oh, A Girl Walks Home Alone at Night.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? Yeah, great movie.
It was, that was Anna Lily Amanpour.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Amanpour, yeah.
Amanpour, right. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Great movie. Yeah, he shot both of her films. What's the other one?
The Bad Batch.
Bad Batch, yeah. So my friend Lyle Vincent shot both of her films and is a pretty successful cinematographer in his own right. And way back in the day, he and I were going to make my first film together, which was called Little Tokyo Ghost Story. And we wanted to shoot it in Little Tokyo, LA, and where I was living at the time. And so we shot a little, you know, for like a couple $100, shot a little demo trailer, and it actually took off, and we almost got that movie financed, but it didn't happen. Anyways, I haven't actually worked with Lyle besides that, but I wanted Lyle to film this, and I knew I couldn't afford him anymore. So I said, Lyle, I know I can't really afford you, man. I know you got a wife and kids and whatnot and going on, but who do you know in Chicago when you come here to do commercials or whatnot? Who do you know that, you know, or maybe they're not in Chicago, maybe they're in New York, but, or LA, but, and so, yeah, he's worked with Chris a lot when he comes here to shoot. So he was like, oh yeah, you got to use Rahano. You got to use Chris Rahano. Yeah. And then I built up Chris to shoot this like epic black and white, Chicago mobster movie called Beata. That was what I mentioned earlier, which was the movie we were trying to finance for. And it was like, and he was just like, oh God, I can't, this is like a wet dream for me. I can't wait to shoot like this, these gorgeous black and white architectural shots. And oh, this is going to be awesome. And yeah. And then I had to tell him like, okay, so we're not doing that. We're shooting a rural, like, you know, movie about some strange aging movie. I don't even know. And he was like, oh, he had the same reaction that the financiers had, which was like, what? What? It sounds weird.
Well, the other movie sounds interesting, but I mean, for having to settle for a different direction, I think this is this is quite the feat. Yeah.
It was really wise, man. I mean, it was a good match for my talents. Just the story, and just like to be able to like, yeah, it was a good match for like the skill sets that James and I had, because he's in the movie as well. James Sharp plays Carl, a sort of down and out private eye who's hired to go find them, the nurse and Tom. And so, yeah, it wound up being good. And then in terms of getting all those production value shots, like you initially asked, how'd you get on the L? How'd you get how did you get the horse ranch? And they're like, yeah, all these, I know, it's impossible. I don't know how the hell I did it, but I talked to people. That's how I did it. I think a lot of my skill set is, you know, I'm not really officially a producer on this movie because I'm just not good with paperwork, but I'm good at talking to people and assuming they're going to say no, but making friends with them anyway. And then by the end of it, having it say like, all right, what the hell? All right, we'll let you guys shoot it. So yeah, I got a lot of this stuff for free. The L train was stolen.
The L train
was stolen. Yeah. And I probably shouldn't say who told me to steal it, but it was some official people. I'll just say that. Some official
people. Was it Rahm Emanuel, like on his way out? He was like, I just take it.
I mean, it was almost like that. It was kind of like that. It was like people with the CTA and people with the, you know, I'm not naming names because I don't want to get them in trouble. But yes, they were basically like, yeah, you should just steal that. You got a short little scene there. Just steal it because the budget of your entire movie will be eaten up if you try to actually get permitted for that. Wow. So that's how that, but everything else besides the L train, everything else was actually was above board and legal and just through talking and also quite honestly through using the whole, like, I'm a student, you know, like, like, I mean, it's really, you know, yes, it's a weird experience because it's like, yes, I had all this experience behind the scenes of how to, you know, shoot action scenes in downtown LA for, you know, get around corners. But I was a student. I was still really genuinely like I was learning shit. I was learning how to edit. I was learning how to do stuff. So yes, I was not afraid to sort of wave I'm just a student making a little student movie. You know, here's my ID. And so I kind of, yeah, I use the best of both worlds, the professional and the feel bad for me. I'm a broke student, to get a lot of shit done, you know?
Well,
that's tricky.
Well, one of the questions of, I guess, necessity, or is it vanity? You cast yourself as the lead in this movie. You are Tom. And then Jim, as you mentioned, is Carl, the PI. Was that always, because he helped you like conceive the story, right? I think.
Yeah, James and I really mapped out the story together over a course of a week or two in June or July of, I guess it was like back in 2017. Yeah. So
was that, did you write those parts for yourselves, or was it just like, no one can play these? We have to play these parts because we can't find anyone who can quite nail it.
It was a mix of both. It was pretty much set that I was going to play. I mean, we knew that I had made a short film called Studio as a sort of a test run of me doing Mr. All Hats thing, where I'm acting in it, I'm directing it, I wrote it, I edited it, and score the music for it. It was a pretty successful short film that won some awards and played well internationally. So I felt pretty confident that, and all my backgrounds in acting, really, I started out in Chicago theater and whatnot. And yeah, this was my chance to like, okay, I'm going to be that guy that writes and directs and acts in his movies and sounds very obnoxious until you sort of see the movie and then you go, you can do it. So, yes, it was, if I could have gotten, you know, Steve Carell or some name A-list actor to play Tom, you know, age 35 plus to whatever he lives. Yeah, I would have done that. But I knew that there was just going to be, we were saving a lot of money if I was acting a lot of those days, all the money. I'm a SAG actor and I got paid, but then it went right back into the movie, like the paycheck. So, as did James's paycheck for that matter. So there was a lot of money that was being saved and going right back into the movie. And then I also knew how much of a pain in the ass it was going to be for a lot of special makeup shots towards the last third of the movie. It was really going to be, quite a thing. So that was kind of it. And in terms of James, I was casting around for that part, and I was not able to find the actor that could pull that part off. And James said he's a very good actor. He's a very experienced actor. I would say he's one of the best actors in the movie, actually. And James said, why don't you let me audition for it? You know? And I'm like, well, audition, I mean, you don't have to audition for it. Like, I know you can act, you can, you know, I see this guy as being a little heavier, a little kind of pouchier. And he's like, well, I'll start eating donuts. And he did. He started eating donuts, looking like shit, growing a beard out. And oh yeah, he's great. He's great. But I was more nervous about that, because I just think producing is just impossible. It's just a really hard job. You're running around, you're trying to take care of everybody. Everybody's just like kissing your ass and then also hating you at the same time. It's just really, it's a mess. But he was able to do a really good job of producing the hell out of this movie and then acting that part. So it was, yeah. But a lot of it, no, it's like, yes, if I had a big budget, Hollywood budget for this movie, no, I don't think I would act in it, or I'd act maybe in a smaller role. I'm all for, you know, I'm old school. I know you need a star to get people to look at these movies, but, you know.
Well, it worked. You know, that, especially the final scene, I won't give anything away, but yeah, I've been thinking about that since I saw the movie. It's just really, it's impactful.
Thanks.
Now, you're kind of closing out. Your film is premiering at the Music Box this coming weekend, as I mentioned. As a Chicagoan, what does it feel like to have your independent film having its premiere at an iconic landmark theater like the Music Box.
Yeah, I know. I know. It's I'm honestly, I'm very humbled by it, and I'm really trying to like just enjoy it. Like, cause it really is like that the movie theater that, you know, like I was talking about going down to Chicago as a kid and just being awed by it. It was also like my first like big old fashioned movie theater that I would go to and go see revivals of old movies. And so I have such a rich history, my personal history with that theater, that it's phenomenal. I mean, it's really, I feel very blessed and really lucky sadly, it's like this whole time with COVID, it's just been such hell, but I don't know that I would have gotten a shot to have my movie get booked and if it wasn't for COVID. So it's kind of a weird, you know, situation, but I'll take it. I'll take it. And it's going to be really cool. The other cool thing is the movie premiered at film festivals. I mean, it was doing pretty well in the film festival world. It was going to do its big premiere and did its actual festival premiere in 2020 at Cinequest in Silicon Valley.
Okay.
Just as COVID broke. Like, it was such a nightmare. It was like the whole city was just rats fleeing a sinking ship. I mean, and there I was with my movie premiering to like a theater of like three people or four people. And it was, they liked it, but it was very like, oh God, not only is no one going to see my movie, I think the world's ending. This is horrible. Like, it was ridiculous. So it's exciting to kind of have a little like, you know, and since then I should say the movie has premiered online. It did actually premiere online, but this is definitely its theatric, it's like limited exclusive theatrical premiere. And I haven't seen the movie yet projected. I saw it at Cinequest and I saw another projected version, but I did make changes to the movie since then, since it got picked up by Gravitas Ventures and got distributed via Amazon and whatnot, streaming services. But I hadn't actually seen the changes that I made. And I did considerable changes to the sound mix, mostly, not really to picture. And so I'm excited to see it in 5.1 sound. I'm very proud of the music as well with I'm having a good time. I'm going to go rehearse with the band members today. We're going to play three live songs before Saturday's 7:00 showing. So if you want to come to the Music Box between 5:45 and 6:45 on Saturday, May 8th, you'll be able to see some live songs performed and get a drink. And, you know, I think the movie might be sold out, though. I think that showing, the 7:00 May 8th showing, is sold out, but plenty of tickets available for other showings. So get out and go see a movie. Get your vax and then get relaxed and go chill out in the movie theater, right?
Is that a new slogan, vaxin' and relaxin'?
I don't know. Could catch on.
And you're doing a Q&A afterwards, right? With Pat McDonald of Hollywood Chicago.
That's right. Yes.
I don't know if you know Pat, but you're in great hands. He's awesome. He's a frequent guest on this show.
Great. I think I met him just briefly once before, but okay. Cool. That's great. I'm looking forward to that. Should be fun. Doing anything these days should be fun. it's like there's something happening. Go do it. It'll be fun.
Now, the very last thing, half the proceeds from the premiere, I believe, at the Music Box are going to Saving Tiny Hearts, a nonprofit that's committed to eliminating congenital heart disease. What can you tell me about the connection between that and your film?
Yeah, really a very just loving connection that I have with the Paul family, who earlier I mentioned I cast Judah Paul as the young Tom at 8, who's great and been in a couple other pretty successful movies. And then I cast his older brother, Joshua, as the character of Tom at the age of 12. And as I found out, as we were working and as working with their parents, that I hope this is okay for me to say for them. I think it is, but that's just that Joshua was born with a congenital heart situation, and it was really touch and go in his first, you know, few years of life. And through the great people at, I think it was Lurie Children's Hospital, he was able to recover, and they started this nonprofit foundation, Saving Tiny Hearts, and they raised money, as you said, for children born with congenital heart problems. And so, yeah, the Paul family were instrumental in not just the talented kids, but also the parents in helping me, like, pull off that beautiful kickball scene at that grammar school, my old grammar school where I used to play kickball because their kids would go to school. So they were, and they just were extremely supportive. So I anything I can do to help their foundation, even in a small way, I feel very strongly about and passionate about and indebted to them. So it's really through the Paul family and their foundation. And so, yeah, so come out and check out the movie, and then, you know, half that money is going to, you know, do some good.
So. Awesome. Well, congratulations on the film. I think it's going to be, you know, hopefully it'll be a big hit and lead to other, you know, great, it's going to have a second act in your life of going out and making the movies you want to make.
Thanks.
Yeah, congrats again. Everybody check out Tom of Your Life. Jer, thank you so much for staying over with me. I know we're a bit over time, but yeah, I'll have to catch you on the next one.
That was great, Ian. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. Yeah. Thanks for asking me out.
All right, man. Take care.
All right. Have a good one. Bye-bye.
Bye.